loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, we discuss the implications of a new round of fierce economic sanctions directed against Russia announced by the Trump administration. Then, dozens of people, including many, many children, were killed in Yemen today by an airstrike launched by the Saudi-led coalition waging war on that country. We should say the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. The bombing, which hit a school bus, is causing outrage around the world. And then today we continue our weekly series, which happens every Thursday, called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those three stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, besieged Gazans fired on Israel last night and received massive rocket fire in return. This happened as a ceasefire was in the works. So what happened? Next, the count of fatalities in Puerto Rico during Hurricane Maria was initially assessed at 64, but according to a revised report submitted to Congress today, the number of fatalities is actually 1,427. Then, Venezuela's Supreme Court has ordered the arrest of former head of the National Assembly, Julio Borges, who currently lives in exile in Colombia. And then, Brazil's Workers' Party yesterday nominated imprisoned former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva as its presidential candidate, despite the fact that the Supreme Court will likely seek to keep him off the ballot. Meanwhile, far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro, who is a front-runner, chose an outspoken general as his running mate. General Hamilton Mourão has spoken in favor of a military coup in Brazil. And finally, we continue our series called Stories from the National Museum of African American History and Culture, where Dr. Alice Bonner highlights some of the most important episodes in Black history. Today, we talk about Ida B. Wells. And in other headlines, a new email has come to light sent by Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh in 2001, and it's causing controversy. In it, Kavanaugh, who at the time was working in the Bush administration, instructed another employee to prepare a brief for then-Attorney General John Ashcroft on the use of military tribunals in terrorism cases. Kavanaugh had previously faced questioning regarding his possible involvement in the Bush-era torture program. Tribune Media is suing Sinclair, the largest broadcasting network, for its failed merger and is asking for $1 billion in damages. This move will likely open up Tribune to new purchase offers. Many groups have been vocal opponents of the two giants merging. Protesters filled the streets in Argentina's capital of Buenos Aires yesterday to protest the Senate's vote to reject the partial legalization of abortion. The vote was 31 in favor of legalization and 38 opposed. The National Campaign for the Right to Legal, Safe, and Free Abortion has vowed to continue the fight in spite of this setback. Julian Assange's lawyer said today that he is considering the request from the Senate Intelligence Committee for Julian to appear and testify on the alleged 2016 Russian election meddling. The attorney said that Assange's protection would have to be guaranteed. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to U.S.-Russian relations. The latest round of sanctions targeting Russia is already taking a toll as forces in the United States military and foreign policy establishment continue their campaign to ensure that the two countries remain on a collision course. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. Mark, welcome back.
Brian, John, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
These are, I would say all the sanctions are a bit gratuitous, but this seems to be extra gratuitous. Here's the U.S. imposing sanctions, which might be very, very draconian or maybe less draconian, but over the Skripals. Anyway, what's your take? What's your initial take?
Yeah, well, this seemed to come as kind of a surprise, I think, to Moscow. This this round of sanctions, and it has to be said that Congress is simultaneously pursuing another round of sanctions on Russian state banks and investment in Russian government bonds, trying to restrict that. But this one appears to be triggered by the Chemical and Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act of 1991, where the an obscure law, by the way, which the U.S. basically obligated itself to pursue countries that it considers in violation of the proliferation or use of chemical and biological weapons. The irony here, of course, is that the U.S. and Russia bilaterally signed deals to get rid of their chemical weapons. Russia did so and was certified multiple times, including most recently in September by the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, who have done so, and the U.S. has not. But this was triggered evidently when President Trump agreed with the British highly likely assessment that it could only have been Russia without any evidence, without any suspects or something several months ago. And this has been developing since. There's a three-month lag time here. And actually, it appears that the Trump administration waited an extra month. They're a month past due, not altogether unusual for this sort of thing, but they're actually a month behind the ball here. And there will be a first wave of this, and then there are demands on Russia that they apologize for what they've done, supposedly done, that they guarantee that they won't do so again in the future, and that they allow more on-site inspections of their supposed chemical weapons facilities by the UN or the OPCW or so on. And then if Russia doesn't meet those, then there is an automatically triggered, much more severe round of sanctions that could see practically all travel to and from the U.S., direct travel to and from the U.S., and all trade, imports and exports between Russia and the U.S. stop completely.
That is draconian.
Yeah, so you're paying careful attention, Mark Sloboda. Is that, you think that's in the cards?
The fact that this is pretty much being triggered automatically, I can't see either the U.K. or the U.S. backing off their completely evidenceless claims over this Skripal affair, which, of course, neither of the two Skripals died from this supposed military-grade nerve agent that they were opposed to. So this almost seems to be on autopilot at this point. And I don't know that there is a face-saving or even a way, if there is an exit ramp at this point, to get off of this, because this is all obligated under this 1991 law that Trump evidently triggered when he made that assessment based on whatever it is. And we don't know that the U.S. has any new information or anything. Heather Nauert at the State Department press briefing announcing these sanctions, when pressed, what is the evidence? Is there new evidence? Is something like that, because no evidence has been presented. She's just said repeatedly, I'll leave that to others, and unspecified others, because no one has stepped forward to provide any information, not the U.S. intelligence community, not the British government, no one. So I can't see where this will be stopped at this point, because we are in automatic mode operating under requirements from U.S. laws that were triggered several months ago.
And that's really the dangerous part of this issue. These are automatic sanctions. Unless the Russians agree to special U.N. weapons inspections and they promise never to use chemical weapons against people again, which are both non-starters, these sanctions are going to kick in immediately. I was looking at a piece in the New York Times today. It's echoed in the British press, saying that already because of the early stage of recovery that the Russian economy is in right now, and solely on the back of rising oil prices, the ruble dropped 1.9%, and the Russian stock market dropped precipitously. And it's just because they understand, too, that these sanctions are automatic, they're likely going to happen, and it just pushes us farther and farther down that road toward conflict.
Yeah, the first round that is automatically triggered, which should come into force on August 22nd, concerns so-called dual-use technology.
Right.
Technology that could have potentially a military use. Right now, that is on a case-by-case approval to give that export license to U.S. companies by the U.S. government. The default from that will then move to an automatic no.
Automatic no. And then a company could try to make the point that their product isn't a dual-use technology, which will be impossible. They'll never be able to actually prove it.
Well, it's one of those when did you stop beating your wife kind of questions.
There are exceptions, of course, for space-use technology because the U.S. is still, they still rely on Russian rockets, Soyuz, to get their astronauts to and from the space station. So that's always been exempt. But there are increasing calls in Moscow, political calls. First of all, there's a lot of anger here. The U.S. aside, there's a lot of anger at the Russian president right now because there's a general feeling that Putin has been too soft in responding to this. The last couple rounds of these unilateral sanctions have gone by without any response from Russia at all, other than some initial rhetoric. And there's a response here that Russia's got to hit back and hit back hard, perhaps harder, although it's hard to see how that could be. And if space technology, blocking U.S. agricultural goods, ending cooperation on the space program, these are all things that are being considered. And we've had military advisors in Moscow today that said that Putin needs to stop dancing around, and that it's high past time for Russia to start treating sanctions as an actual act of war on Russia, like the U.S. has declared that cyber attacks are an actual act of war on it.
I'm glad you raised this, because it really occurs to me, watching this from a distance, and of course we're not politicians and we're not in government, we're just watching, and when you see the thing, the Russian government has been very polite. The language is our partners in the West, even when our partners are like, trying to strangle you economically. The U.S. sanctions Russia and then in turn tries to be a partner with Russia in sanctioning North Korea. You know, it's like this kind of this thing that just keeps going and going and going, and there's no price at all to be paid. And these politicians in Washington, they feel completely immunized from consequences because all they can do is, get patted on the back for being tough guys.
It's kind of interesting to see how this is going to play out this time, because there's no word yet on how the European Union, whether they will follow suit this time, because that would be much more severe effect on their economy than it would on the U.S. U.S.-Russian trade is actually pretty minimal. It went up slightly last year, but it's around $20 billion worth of trade. Russian-EU trade is at well more than 10 times that amount. One thing that the U.S. will be affected by is gasoline prices will go up, because the U.S. Actually imports its second highest amount of gasoline, not from Canada, from Russia. So expect gasoline prices to be going up in the U.S. if this fully takes effect here. But the U.S. is sanctioning and or tariffing countries all over the world at this point. Iran, tariff war with China, tariffs against Canada, tariffs against South American countries, threatening sanctions against India and Turkey if they continue with military deals with Russia. They're threatening EU companies for doing business with Iran. They're threatening EU companies if they continue to do business with Russia. You know, Trump has basically put the U.S. in a position where it's declared economic war on the world at this point. And so it's kind of interesting how this latest round will be heard, at least in Europe, where the U.S. is threatening to tariff and sanction them as well.
Any impact, Mark Sloboda, on Syria? Because in Syria, the U.S. and Russian military are, at least at the level of the colonels, on a regular, you know, 10 times a day sort of communication to make sure they're not blowing up each other's troops. What about the Syria? Any consequences there?
I don't see any immediate consequences there, other than, of course, a general ratcheting up in tensions. There was an alarming incident yesterday in Estonia. A Spanish fighter jet that was part of the buildup of NATO troops on Russia's border was patrolling the Russian border and somehow accidentally fired a missile, which shouldn't really be possible, and then the missile was lost. They don't know where it is, where it hit, where it landed. So NATO just accidentally, in a period of very high military and political tensions, just accidentally lost the missile in the general direction of Russia. And this is what makes this whole situation and this buildup of tensions so, and of course the massing of troops right on Russia's border, you know, from countries halfway around the world like the United States, Spain, et cetera, it makes it all so very terrifying.
You know, it is. And all of these things, well, accidents happen. Yeah, but if they happen where the missile is accidentally fired at Russia on Russia's border by a NATO warplane. Was the Spanish plane a NATO? Was it a NATO exercise?
Yeah, it was a part of a NATO patrol.
Okay, so yeah, can you imagine, John, if at the U.S.-Canadian border that, say, a Russian plane fired a missile by mistake and we can't find it? I mean, what do you think the reaction would be?
We would run directly to the U.N. General Assembly and lodge protests in capitals, and
that's the mild part of what would happen.
Yeah.
True. I mean, can you imagine? Anyway, Americans can't imagine because they're shielded from any sort of actual knowledge because they're getting most of their news from the corporate owned media. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Dozens of people, including many children, were killed in Yemen today by an airstrike launched by the Saudi-led coalition waging war against the people of that country. The bombing, which hit a school bus, is causing outrage around the world. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Medea Benjamin. Medea is an anti-war activist, and she is the co-founder of Code Pink. She's also a journalist. Medea Benjamin, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Brian.
Another gruesome, awful story here. Anyway, can you talk about it?
Well, it's just absolutely disgusting. I mean, here the Saudis bombed a school bus that was full of children, most of them under the age of 10. We're hearing reports that 43 people were killed, dozens more wounded, and this is something that's been happening on a regular basis with the Saudis bombing markets, schools, hospitals, residential areas. But now to have dozens of children that have been killed, it's time that we just say enough is enough.
Yeah, that's Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink. Medea, I'm looking at media pictures, these children, I mean, the ones who are surviving, drenched in blood, body parts all over the place. How can the U.S. government, and I'm talking not just about Trump, as odious as Trump is, but you have the Congress, the Democrats, and the Republicans, continuing to send huge amounts of military to Saudi Arabia? And I think you know more than I about this. I mean, the U.S. is refueling the Saudi bombers in midair, helping to pick bombing targets. Why? What's the point here?
The point is all about the money that the weapons companies in the U.S. are making from selling these weapons to Saudi Arabia. It's the most grotesque thing, Brian, that this is all about billions of dollars in weapon sales. And it just makes me sick as a mother and as a grandmother to see these little kids, some of them with the backpacks still on their backs, just with blood all over them and the shocked kind of look in their eyes, the ones who survived. This is the most obscene way that people are making money in the United States from selling of these weapons. And now you see with the problems that the Canadians are having because they criticized the Saudis for having arrested some activists from Saudi Arabia, the women activists, and how the Saudi government is responding by saying, we're going to stop the investments that we have in your country. We're going to stop buying weapons from you anymore. And that's billions of dollars in weapon sales. They're retaliating with billions of dollars that the Canadians will then, quote, lose. The U.S. knows that this is how the Saudis run, that if the U.S. Even just condemns the Saudis for killing dozens of children, Saudis will retaliate by saying, we're going to stop buying weapons from you.
Yeah, it's really something. The Canadian foreign minister tweeted, she tweeted something about, as you mentioned, people who had been activists who had been detained in Saudi Arabia. So they cut off all trade, cut off all economic interaction with the country. They demanded that the 16,000 Saudi students who were on scholarship and going to school in Canada be immediately out of the country, that no Saudis can receive medical coverage or medical treatment in Canada. I mean, very, very comprehensive, to which the State Department, the spokesperson, Nowert, said, oh, we don't have any position. That's a battle between these two countries. Again, a deafening silence from the U.S. media about the underlying issue, which is that the United States continues to fund and sell arms to the Saudis. Then I saw a story, Medea, yesterday that in the midst of all that, the Saudis decided to crucify, as a method of execution, a man from Myanmar who had been convicted of theft and murder. I mean, that was yesterday. Again, you would think if the U.S. media wanted, because we know the U.S. media is quite adept at demonizing a targeted entity, they certainly can. This is a lot to work with. But again, no, just business as usual.
Well, you know, you think at some point, Brian, it's going to have to be too much. And when is that point going to be happen? If the Iranian government bombed a bus full of children in another country, all hell would break loose and the U.S. would start bombing Iran. The fact that the Canadian government did a tiny little thing of condemning the Saudis for imprisoning women activists, and the kind of reaction of the Saudis to say, don't you dare interfere with our country and you will have to apologize for this. Every State Department in the world that says it cares about human rights should say, we side with Canada. We are against the Saudi imprisonment of women activists, and Saudi stop blackmailing with the money that you get from selling oil. And if everybody stood up to the Saudis, this would end. But they don't. They only care about the Saudi money.
Yeah. And when Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who's the real power in Saudi Arabia, came to the United States, I mean, he went to MIT, he went to Harvard, he went to Hollywood. I think he met with Oprah. I mean, and he was touted as this great reformer. Really, I mean, the red carpet was rolled out. So you're right. It is the military-industrial complex. It's also all of these other kind of core, well-known institutions that seem to be also embracing the Saudi royal family, no matter what criminal conduct they have. I mean, it's not just allowing it to go forward. They're exorcising the negative reputation of Mohammed bin Salman and treating him as if he's like a guy on a white horse, you know, about to lead the country into the 21st century. It's really quite amazing.
It is. And we've gone back to as many of the people we could find who he met with and wrote to them and said and gave examples of the women who had been fighting for the right to drive being jailed while the crown prince is taking credit for giving them the right to drive, and asking the people who he met with to condemn this. And we get silence as a response. So you're right. It is the weapons companies, but it's also all the PR firms that are getting so much money. And then the Ivy League colleges are getting money as well. And then the Saudis are investing in U.S. companies like Uber, like Hollywood, like the oil companies here, and they own the largest refinery. They have a chokehold now on the U.S. economy. And just like they're trying to show their strength with Canada right now, they could easily do that with the United States, but they couldn't do it if the world community stood up to the Saudis. And so we have to go back, as you were implying, to the people from the Oprahs to the deans of Harvard and MIT and Yale, and say to them, stand up to the Saudis, force the U.S. government to stand up to the Saudis.
Yeah, I'm looking at the New York Times coverage of Mohammed bin Salman's trip here. This is April 6, 2018. Again, for our audience, we're talking to Madia Benjamin. She is an activist. She's been struggling for human rights and as an advocate for human rights for women and all people in Saudi Arabia who don't have rights against the Saudi royal family. And we're talking about the fact that the Saudis bombed a bus in Yemen, killing all these kids. I mean, awful. I mean, just look at the images. Go online. Look at the images. It's hard to stomach. It's hard to even look. But people should look and just see what's happening. I'm looking at this article in the Times, April 6, 2018. It's a picture of a smiling Mohammed bin Salman with Google co-founder Sergey Brin on Friday at Google headquarters in Mountain View, California. They're walking through this sort of lovely, pristine pathway. And here's the first paragraph. He, meaning Mohammed bin Salman, talked about movie business with Michael Douglas, Morgan Freeman, and Dwayne Johnson over dinner at Rupert Murdoch's house. He discussed space travel with Richard Branson in the California desert, and philanthropy with Bill Gates and technology with Jeff Bezos in Seattle. He visited Harvard and MIT, brokered arms deals with President Trump, and sat down with Wall Street financiers. He even met with Oprah Winfrey. I mean, this is bipartisan. It's cultural. It's scientific. It's academic. It's the military-industrial complex. And again, Madia, you're so right. I mean, if this was any other country, a country with this disgusting reputation on human rights in all areas, of course the U.S. media would be denouncing them. Or if it was just an entity that the U.S. government decided to carry out regime change. But speaking of that, I can remember in the early days after the Iranian Revolution and after Ronald Reagan became president of the United States, Reagan went out of his way to say, I'm paraphrasing, but it's almost a quote, there will be no revolution in Saudi Arabia, meaning there won't be a replication of what happened when the U.S. back monarch in Iran was overthrown in 1979. We, America, are just not going to let that happen. I mean, it shows that while the Saudis have a lot of power and a lot of influence, America, too, has sort of thought things through geostrategically and considers the Saudis, like the Israelis, to be linchpins of a U.S. sort of regional plan. Do you see it that way?
It's so sickening that we have thrown our lot in with the Saudi royal family since the time oil was discovered in 1938. And so for decades, we've been protecting this family. And then we have the nerve to say that Iran is the greatest terrorist threat in the world when it's the Saudis who are doing not only these kind of bombings that we've seen, but also spreading its perversion of Islam around the world. And so it is... at some point, we've just got to figure out better how do we work as an anti-war community to stop the ties to Saudi Arabia. It's so destructive for the Middle East. It's destructive for the world. It's destructive if we care about the environment and the climate chaos, because the Saudis are the biggest promoter of oil on all these different levels. We've got to find a way to sever our links with this most repressive royal family. It's not the Saudi people. It's the royal family.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And the pervasive influence of the Saudi royal family, which is tolerated because, opportunistically by all these different sectors of of money making in America and influence peddling in America, it allows this mass murder to go forward. If you don't speak up, if you don't speak out, then it is complicity, and we should just call it for what it is. I totally agree with you. Anyway, we're out of time. That was Medea Benjamin. Medea is an author. She is an anti-war activist, and she is the co-founder of Code Pink. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. Welcome back, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
I would like to start with something that both of you are following. Kevin, you have written about this, and Paul, you and Prison Legal News have been following it for ages. And this is a new development. A judge has certified a class action suit against Geo Group for forced immigrant labor. Kevin, let's start with you. Tell us what you learned in your investigation.
Well, yeah, so this was just a decision that was handed down by a federal court. And basically, it granted the class to these detained immigrants that have been forced to work for about a dollar a day, if they even get that, because in many cases, they find that they're just being rewarded with food or the promise of getting more food or the promise that they'll have better kinds of food to eat for their meals. And so they filed this lawsuit alleging that they had their wages basically stolen and they were denied the wages that they should be getting under the Washington State minimum wage law. And it's not necessarily the first of its kind. And as I mentioned, there's other lawsuits like it. There's actually another lawsuit going that the Washington State Attorney General has brought against Geo Group for not giving the workers their minimum wage. And then basically the reason why Geo Group thinks they can get away with it is the fact that these are volunteers, they say, that they're part of a volunteer work program, and so they don't have to pay them. They're also trying to use immigration policy to like invoke it to get around having to pay the people who are detained in their prisons by saying that, you know, if they were to pay them, they'd be violating certain worker laws that say that you can't hire illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants. And so that's basically lays out the issues at play here. And then I know Paul has a lot of experience following litigations because as I found in putting this report together on the decision, you know, there's cases unfolding in Aurora, Colorado. There's other places that have tried to certify these groups to challenge Geo Group.
Paul, you really do follow these legal developments very closely. That's one of the things that I love about Prison Legal News magazine and also Criminal Legal News magazine. Because the blow-by-blow of these cases is actually very important. The fact that this has been moved to a class action suit, has been given class action status, is very, very important for a lot of people. Tell us your thoughts on this case.
Yeah, I think it's very significant that like you say, it's been granted class certification. In some respects, I think that the most amazing thing, though, is that literally prisoners have been toiling in slavery for as long as they have. And you know, and that's what it is, you know, prisoners are being forced to work without pay or truly nominal pay. And, you know, the thing is, this happens in our regular prisons as well, not just immigration prisons. The difference is that supposedly, you know, and I think this is on the one hand, in real life, it's been a distinction without a difference, but there is a significant legal difference, is that immigration detainees are not considered convicted prisoners, and by its terms, the 13th Amendment, which legalizes slavery, only applies to people that have been convicted of a crime. It doesn't apply to people that are in pretrial detention or, in this case, immigration detention. But these companies are so used to exploiting prisoners and treating them as slaves, regardless of their actual legal status, that that's kind of what's gotten them into this position to begin with. And, you know, and one of the things is, you know, when these companies say that, oh, if we paid them, we'd be violating statutes that make it illegal to employ illegal aliens or undocumented aliens and whatever, it's like, well, okay, but they're not talking about, you know, hiring staff to do this. And I think it's important to note that the federal government pays these companies like $160, $170 a day to hold immigration detainees in captivity. And in most parts of the country, you know, $170 a day, that buys you, you know, maybe not a five-star hotel room, but it buys you a decent hotel room mm-hmm. with three times a day room service, which is not what immigration detainees are getting.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, that's the thing, too. We've said this a million times. I'm going to say it again. The way that these companies make money is to provide as little as they possibly can to the prisoners, right? So they skimp on medical care, on food. You live in terrible conditions. Maybe you get no blanket. Maybe you don't get a winter coat. I mean, they have a million ways to cut costs and treat people, as Paul says, like slaves.
And I think it's almost it's the slumlord model of profiteering. And but the key thing too is that they've just gotten used to exploiting prison slave labor. And I think their thing is, hey, we do it with the convicted prisoners and the pretrial detainees. Let's keep doing it. Let's do it for the immigration prisoners, because otherwise, if they actually had to either pay the prisoners even the minimum wage, or use hire additional staff, then they would take a dent or a ding in their profit margins, and that's unacceptable to them as well. So I think this is it's a long overdue development. Hopefully, you know, they'll be held accountable for their exploitation of immigration detainees. But and again, I think that you know, this shouldn't blind us to the fact or let us neglect the fact that, unfortunately, for convicted prisoners who are not being held in immigration detention, the Constitution allows their enslavement under the 13th Amendment. And that's something that I think desperately needs to be changed.
I want to move on to another issue, too. There was an article in the Miami Herald entitled "Feds to Probe Sexual Extortion, Other Abuse Allegations at Florida Women's Prison." But before we get to that specific story, I wanted to tell you about a piece I read in Rolling Stone recently, which touched on this issue and said that in 35 states, it's actually not illegal for a guard to have sex with a prisoner or for a cop to have sex with somebody that he's arrested or detained. In 35 states, that's not illegal. That was stunning to me. But Kevin, tell us a little bit about this case in Florida.
So what we're pointing to here in this article is the fact that the Miami Herald has for the longest time been trying to document the way in which officers are violating prisoners. And this is something that we've talked about on the show before, so people may feel like we're, you know, revisiting some of this. But we've talked about how when prisoners, especially women, want basic necessities like soap, toilet paper, or feminine hygiene products, that these officers will basically force them into having sex with them in order to get those basic amenities, those things that we take for granted in our lives because, you know, we are not incarcerated. If you're not incarcerated, you think you can always get these. Well, the officer is the person who's going to provide those to you, and so they have no choice. They get forced into performing very degrading acts. And as detailed the allegations within this investigation that the Miami Herald undertook, and now they're hoping, we don't know, probably they won't do a whole lot given who's running the Justice Department these days, but the Civil Rights Division, which has been totally neutered by Jeff Sessions being in charge, now has the opportunity to go look into some of these allegations, like spitting into faces of prisoners, slamming them into concrete walls, and coming into the dorms and rampantly destroying their items, which is very common, actually, for a lot of prisons to have officers just come in there and wreck your entire cell.
Oh, it happened to me.
But again, this is part of, you know, inflicting that sort of humiliation
That's
and
right.
suffering on people.
It's an issue of control, is it not, Paul?
It's absolutely an issue of control, but I think the bigger problem that we have with a lot of the male staff that work at a lot of women's prisons is that, frankly, they seem to view having sex with prisoners in their captivity almost as a job perk. And we've been seeing a lot of complaints about sexual abuse going on in women's prisons here in Florida, but this is also a national phenomenon. And I think there might be a earlier you mentioned about whether or not it's a crime or not. I think it may be okay for or not illegal for policemen or police officers to have sex with people they arrest and stuff like that. But generally, I believe all states have criminalized or made it a criminal offense for prison and jail staff to have sex with the prisoners in their care. It's basically akin to statutory rape, is that the assumption behind this is that prisoners, by virtue of their status as prisoners, are incapable of legally consenting to having sex with basically with their captors. And that said, we've seen this over and over and over again. You know, we report on this stuff around the country every couple of years. Prison Legal News will do basically a national roundup on the prevalence of prisoners being raped by guards and prison staff. And, you know, and it's one of those things that, you know, despite all the talk that there is about sex offenders and, you know, going after sex predators and this and that, you see what happens is when the sex predators are wearing a government uniform and raping people under cover of their government authority and their power as government employees and officials, is that typically you see very lackluster investigations, if any. And then when they are prosecuted, the guards and the prison staff that are raping prisoners, male and female alike, they get very light sentences, if at all. I mean, probation, suspended sentences, probation, stuff like that is, you know, very much the norm. And, you know, you don't see any type of vigorous prosecution. More importantly, the supervisors, the managers that allow this stuff to happen, that don't take steps to investigate or to do anything about these patterns of predation and these patterns of abuse, basically they continue along the way. And I think that one of the things to keep in mind is when we're talking about Florida, it's not just the women prisoners at Lowell that are being systematically raped, but this is in the context, this is the same prison system presided over by Julie Jones that has seen prisoners like Darren Rainey being burned to death by staff and no one was criminally prosecuted. Human Rights Defense Center client Vincent Gaines was starved to death by prison staff. No one was prosecuted. You know, there's just such a litany of horrors and human rights abuses that occur literally on a daily basis here in Florida, that literally the systemic rape of these women prisoners, I mean, this is just, you know, just file this under what's wrong with the Florida prison system. And I'll note that last year, the Human Rights Defense Center, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the ACLU, and a number of other human rights organizations here in Florida, we all sent a letter to the Attorney General asking that their office investigate these human rights abuses occurring in Florida prisons using the resources of the federal government. When the federal government specifically has authority to investigate these matters.
Sure.
And we pointed out to the pattern of, you know, all the rape allegations that we're hearing from women prisoners in Lowell, you know, the well-documented instances of brutality and excessive force murders, the medical neglect deaths that are occurring. And not surprisingly, we haven't heard back from them. So,
yeah.
John, I want to take this discussion back, if we could, because Paul Wright said something that's kind of overarching, or maybe a better way to put it is it's foundational to many, many, many of the problems that we're discussing, including this problem. And I think it goes back to what he said, that slavery actually isn't abolished in the United States. It's legal if you're convicted of a crime. And that then becomes the foundation, in a way, for all of the other degradations and negations of freedom, not freedom, negations of basic, you know, basic treatment of human beings as human beings, as people who are, you know, equal people. Because if you're an enslaved person, you're not equal. And then people can treat you as property because that's what it means to be a slave. So the 13th Amendment of the Constitution, which when Paul, it just jumped out to me, Paul, when you said it, that most people would say, no, wait, slavery's been abolished. But here's what the 13th Amendment actually says. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction.
And that's why you have, right now, as we're speaking, prisoners fighting fires in California, the worst fires in California's recorded history, for $2 a day. And every year this happens, and every year prisoners are burned to death or die from asphyxiation fighting these $2 a day fires.
And what jumps out at me, and I want Paul and Kevin to both speak to this, is that I wonder if you have, say, in Canada or France or the UK or Germany, anything like the 13th Amendment, which shows that the United States had, one, legalized slavery and then made it illegal for a big part of the formerly enslaved population, but still retained in legal form the institution as a legal entity of slavery. I mean, does this exist in any of the other, quote, Western countries?
I'm not aware that it does. And I think that one of the bigger things, though, is part of the reason, I think part of the reason this is not an issue in any industrialized democracies, I think is the same reason the private prisons don't get anywhere in these countries, is that in general, countries that have strong labor movements, they don't have private prisons because their whole premise is basically on underpaying and short-staffing their workforce. So it never even gets out of the box as a serious issue. It just gets laughed away as the preposterous notion that it is in pretty much every civilized country. And I think that's the same thing with the issue of prison slavery, is every country that has a strong labor movement recognizes that enslaving part of your population and forcing them to work at gunpoint for little or no pay drives down the wages of workers as a whole and is bad for society as a whole. You know, you don't want an enslaved caste that basically is toiling away for little or nothing. And yeah, you know, and using the example of the California prisoners that are risking their lives, and as John noted, every year they, a couple of them give their lives, they're making $2 a day fighting fires, defending the homes of billionaires. And I think that's kind of almost the quintessential paradox of American capitalism, is you need those those people making $2 a day defending the homes of people that are worth billions of dollars, and everyone thinks that's okay.
Absolutely right.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I'm reminded of a film that I actually enjoyed, though as of late I'm not the hugest fan of Michael Moore's work. I really found Where to Invade Next fascinating, and he goes to Norway to show off their prison system, which has gotten a lot of press, and he's talking to someone who is a convicted murderer, and he points out that, you know, hey, you're standing around very sharp knives. You're cooking. You're using these objects, and it's quite obvious. Just that visual right there is just quite obvious that there's something very different about the way Norway has chosen to incarcerate people who are convicted of very violent crimes. And I think that, and I'm also reminded of Ava DuVernay's excellent film that she did for Netflix that was called The 13th, which broke this down really. And people should understand from our conversation that that's really the underpinning of the mass incarceration system of the United States. That, like, at its core, it's all about the fact that you're a slave when you are in prison. And, you know, I think the other point I'll make is, in the most basic sense, this goes to a part of our culture, the way that we treat people who are in prisons. And most people, for them, you know, I think we have spent a lot of time with these issues, so we have a more we have a more humane sense of how to handle people who are incarcerated. For the most people who don't follow these issues regularly, the attitude that they would have is that the punishment doesn't just stop with what the judge issues as far as what is given down in the sentence, but it also extends to how you are treated in the prison. So all of this stuff that we're talking about, there are many, many Americans who will say that that's just how it goes. You should not have committed your crime. If you didn't want to be a slave, if you didn't want to work for $1 an hour, if you didn't want to be out getting asphyxiated by smoke from California wildfires, if you didn't want to be in these conditions where officers are raping you, then you should not have committed your offenses and you should not be in prison in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely right. I want to switch to another important issue. Gentlemen, there's been a video going around Facebook of an ICE officer boarding a Greyhound bus outside of Rochester, New York, and asking everybody to prove their citizenship. Now, we've got a law in this country that ICE officers and Border Patrol agents are allowed to ask for identification within, I think it's 100 miles of a border. This is cutting it close. But Paul, as you point out in a piece in Criminal Legal News, that's not the whole story. The rest of the story is that the Greyhound company, the bus company, is working with U.S. Customs and Border Protection to allow their agents onto buses to conduct warrantless searches and to interview passengers without probable cause. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we report in Criminal Legal News is that, unfortunately, this is kind of like a longstanding practice for literally decades, going back to the 80s. Greyhound and other bus companies have basically, you know, allowed and encouraged law enforcement to search their passengers, first under the guise of the war on drugs, now as part of the war on immigration. And, you know, board buses ask passengers for identification, search their bags and everything else, and all this basically, and unfortunately it's been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, where the court has held that it's all permissible to, you know, subject people to, you know, whether it's warrantless searches or have drug sniffing dogs on board or whatever. And this is something that's just happened, you know, it's something that's been happening for decades. And I think that one of the things that we see with the reach of ICE and the Border Patrol is that while nominally they're restricted to 100 miles from the border, the reality is that for a long time, they've been carrying out these searches, you know, farther and farther away from borders, whether it's workplace raids or whatever. I lived in Vermont for around 10 years, and the Border Patrol would frequently set up a checkpoint on I-91, which that's the interstate that goes from Montreal down to New Haven, Connecticut. And the joke among Vermonters is that basically, if you're not white, they stop you and question you. So they're not looking for white Canadians that might be coming to the country illegally. But, you know, if you're black, if you have an accent, if you look darker than they think you should, that's when they're asking you for papers. And I think that's the key thing, is I think that it's important to note that all this talk about immigration, that we're not talking about nannies from Ireland or construction workers from Poland that may be in the country illegally, but basically it's targeting darker-skinned immigrants. It's not even a thing against white immigrants, regardless of their immigration status. And these bus companies have been doing this for a long time. Before, the excuse was the war on drugs, that they were helping the police search for drugs. And again, nearly all the people that were being singled out for these searches were people of color.
I wonder if they could be sued for truth in advertising. because, you know, is it on your ticket when you pay your ticket to go to Rochester, New York, which, by the way, is where I'm from? Do they say, and by the way, we are cooperating with ICE, and you may be liable to be stopped or searched or inspected or interviewed. Anyway, what about the Fourth Amendment? What about the Fourth Amendment, and where the government is not allowed to arbitrarily stop and search someone? I mean, isn't this a flagrant violation of the Fourth Amendment?
Unfortunately, the Supreme Court says it isn't, and that, yeah, at least when they're searching for drugs, that and part of the thing, I think this is also kind of dictates, I think, that or reflects kind of the gilded bubble that our Supreme Court justices live in, because, you know, their thing is, well, you know, if you don't want to be searched, then, you know, you can refuse the search. But the reality is often when police officers are boarding the bus or surrounding the bus, they have drug dogs on board. I don't think that not consenting or refusing the search is really that much of an option. But I think this also reflects the reality that in the United States is primarily poor people that travel by bus. These are generally people who can't afford a car. We don't have that much of a system of public transportation, certainly between a lot of cities and areas that don't involve air travel. And so I think that going into this calculation that who's traveling on the bus is, I think, our Supreme Court has basically viewed it as it's mostly poor people, so who cares? If you're too poor to afford a car or to travel on your own, then you're just kind of stuck with whatever the government wants to do in terms of in terms of searching you, asking you for papers or whatever, even if it's something that car travelers wouldn't necessarily be subjected to.
All right, if it's constitutional, as according to the Supreme Court, then I go for the truth in advertising, that it should be part of the terms of service. You may be searched when you buy your ticket here on Greyhound. I mean, in terms of consumer fraud.
That's,
I mean,
only fair.
They're not advertising that part of the trip. Go ahead.
Well, so I was just going to add that I wrote about this back in March because the ACLU was making an appeal whether it was going to bear any fruit or not. They figured it was worth it to tell Greyhound that they believe they did not have to be allowing the Border Patrol officers to come and violate passengers' rights on their buses, that they had no obligation to allow these warrantless raids, and that basically they did not have to facilitate these violations of civil rights that are ongoing. And they made this, you know, very, I think, reasonable effort to try and inform Greyhound and make sure that they recognize that this is something that they shouldn't be doing as a company. Obviously, as we're talking about this now, they have not made any changes. They are not willing to stand up for passengers. Unfortunately, we have monopolies on routes in the United States. There aren't very, very many bus companies. You can say maybe passengers don't really have the ability to just choose another bus service if all that is taking them from a place to place is a Greyhound service. So they would have to subject themselves to going on Greyhound. So I think you do raise something important here, which is since the law itself has let us down, the Supreme Court won't find it as a violation of the Fourth Amendment, then, you know, the only thing left, though it may seem feeble, is creating a cost to that company. And I think part of showing cell phone videos, part of making publicity really bad for the company might be trying to get it to enforce civil rights. Because we know that while it doesn't really correct everything, there has been some success when it comes to privacy and creating costs for those Silicon Valley companies that didn't care about privacy. And they have had to go through certain nuisances and issues. Mm-hmm. I think the same could be done here with Greyhound.
And that's where we come in. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
That's where we come in. We're going to have to leave it there, though. I can't believe how quickly the segment went. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. Kevin is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News Magazine. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.